You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Strobe Talbot, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here to Brookings on a lovely fall afternoon. My colleague and the master of ceremonies of this event, Richard Bush, has already told you the reason for a slight delay, and we all appreciate your patience. Your patience will be rewarded, I assure you of that. We are very, very fortunate to have Kay Shanmugam, the Minister of Law and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the State of Singapore with us today. And very shortly, we will have Susan Rice, President Obama's National Security Advisor, who I might add is also a former colleague of ours here at the Brookings Institution. She spent about 8 years as a senior fellow in our foreign policy program. And she will arrive, we hope, in time to catch at least some of the wisdom that we are going to hear from the minister. The event today is not only a chance to hear from two very important statesmen, a statesman and a stateswoman, I should say, but it's also a chance for us to announce formally the creation of the Lee Kuan Yew Chair in Southeast Asian Studies here at the Brookings Institution. This has been made possible by a fairly broad and diverse set of supporters of the Brookings Institution who felt, as we do, that it's very important that we have that region of the world, Southeast Asia, represented by a senior fellow here at the institution. The chair, this is somewhat of an innovation on our part as we deal with what is a very coherent region, but also one with a diversity of countries, is going to rotate. So we're going to have a new expert with new areas of expertise serving in the chair for 2 or 3 years. That the chair is housed in our Center for East Asia Policy Studies, led by Richard Bush, and the inaugural holder of the chair is Joseph Liao, who is here in the front row and has already started work and has already proved to be a terrific addition to the Brookings community. Professor Liao has also been an associate dean at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. His areas of expertise include Muslim politics and civil society in Southeast Asia, and also the dynamics of international politics in the ASEAN region. And we're very, very glad to have him with us. The minister is going to open the program with some remarks. Susan will arrive during those remarks, and then she and Joseph will join the minister for a discussion. So with that, and once again with thanks for your patience, I turn the microphone over to our distinguished guest.
Thanks, Strobe, and Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Modern East Asia, including Southeast Asia, is what it is today because of the crucial role that the United States played in underwriting security in Asia Pacific. The U.S. provided security and stability. It helped to stem the tide of communism. The Seventh Fleet kept the sea lanes open. The U.S. generously opened its markets to the region. And that sustained economic growth and prosperity of many Asian countries. In turn, that created conditions that allowed East Asia, beginning with Japan, to seize opportunities to uplift their people's lives. And China is the most recent example of that. Success of countries in the region created a dynamism which has also created new challenges and opportunities. And let me add, while the U.S. did all of it, the U.S. was also a prime beneficiary of this process So it was in the United States' enlightened self-interest to do it, which is one of the things that our former Prime Minister, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, has consistently said in every forum possible. If we now look at the new opportunities and challenges, China is the world's second largest economy, as well as an economic and strategic competitor for influence in East Asia. The US and China have to find an equilibrium that both can accept. How a rising China and a preponderant United States will structure a new relationship is of crucial importance to the region. As a region in which both US and Chinese interests are at stake, Southeast Asia finds itself the center of these complexities. At the same time, political transitions are underway in almost every Southeast Asian country. The context of the transition differs from country to country. These are not just routine electoral changes, but deep systemic changes which are likely to have lasting long-term impact. For instance, post-Suharto Indonesia has done well, especially under President SBY, and there are high expectations for the next president, Jokowi, to keep this up. The Thai government is trying to earn legitimacy and faces the challenge of regaining domestic and international confidence for the country. The government in Myanmar is grappling with the pace of political change in conjunction with economic development and the influx of investments. ASEAN has managed to keep the peace amongst its members for the past 40-odd years, but it faces new challenges, social, economic, strategic, political. The foundation of any new East Asian equilibrium and architecture will be dependent on the evolving US-China dynamics characterized by competitive cooperation. How the historical and deep-rooted tensions between China and Japan are managed will also be critical. How the US-Japan alliance endures will be a crucial question in the current East Asian system. If India under Prime Minister Narendra Modi revitalizes, India will also be part of the new equation. There is broad consensus across East Asia about the need for a workable architecture to preserve stability for growth. The debate over a new East Asian architecture reflects the strains and rivalries that it seeks to mitigate. In the continued search for this new architecture, no country really wants to go to war. Hence, there is a broad recognition of the need for continued presence of the US in the region, not just militarily, but also economically, because the US presence anchors stability, and 40% of the world's GDP is likely to be in this region in the coming years, within the next 8 to 10 years. So US prosperity and success is also very closely tied to stability in East Asia. Having a broad consensus about the need for a workable architecture identifies the problem but does not prescribe a solution. No one really knows how the final architecture might look like, if indeed there is going to be a final architecture. There are many significant regional fora, APAC, APT, the ARF, the ACD. Welcome, Dr. Rice. EAS and SEO. Would the final architecture be more open and one of multiple overlapping frameworks reflecting the complex diversity of the region? Or would it be focused or formed by one or two countries? This will be one of the factors which may significantly influence the regional architecture and therefore the global architecture in the 21st century. There are many crises, Middle East, other regions, which demand America's bandwidth. But there is no region in the world where American influence is challenged or is likely to be challenged as seriously as in East Asia. And the US understands the importance of remaining engaged in Asia Pacific. We welcome the continued concrete implementation of the U.S. rebalance to Asia. The rebalance cannot only be military, it has to be economic as well. In East Asia, including Southeast Asia, economics is strategy. It is crucial for the U.S. to secure the TPP. That is strategically important and an anchor of the U.S. economic strategy in Asia. And the TPP is not the only trade agreement being looked at. There are other regional FTAs negotiated which do not include the U.S. There is good progress on the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership that started 3 years after the TPP. Discussions about an Asia-Pacific-wide FTA, or FTAAP, are being taken forward in APAC. China has proposed a significant upgrading in the ASEAN-China FTA. In this context, and again reminding ourselves that the bulk of the world's economic growth and prosperity is going to be centered in the Asia-Pacific, if the TPP does not succeed, then America will be significantly disadvantaged in the world's most dynamic trading region. And there will be profound implications on U.S. influence in the region and indeed on U.S. prestige. There are many questions, many issues, which will have a deep impact on the U.S., on Asia, and indeed the rest of the world. It is therefore extremely timely that this chair is being launched. Our hope and wish is that the Brookings Institution, through the work of the Lee Kuan Yew Chair for Southeast Asian Studies, can play an important role in increasing awareness and understanding of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for those very stimulating remarks. You have demonstrated something that I learned a long time ago, that the best source of sound advice that the United States can possibly get about its role in East Asia and the world is from our friends in Singapore. Thank you. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce someone who needs no introduction, so I won't take your time or her time, but just to say please join me in welcoming a good friend of Brookings and the assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, Dr. Susan Rice.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be back at Brookings. This was my place for 6 years, and since my mother and I both worked here so long, it really has the feel of home. And this is also where I met so many gracious and insightful colleagues whom I still turn to for guidance and support. And of course, when I was working here was the last time that I actually got 7 hours of sleep a night, so I'm more than a little nostalgic. Strobe, I want to thank you, and Martin, who's not able to be here today, for inviting me to participate. Thank you also very much, Richard. I'm honored to be here with Foreign Minister Shanmugam. President Obama and I had the privilege of meeting with Prime Minister Lee at the White House a few months ago to affirm the excellent partnership between Singapore and the United States. And I think it's fitting that Brookings' new chair in Southeast Asian Studies is named for Singapore's founding father, a man who's played such a key role in shaping the region's growth, Lee Kuan Yew. In many ways, Singapore embodies the arc of development that nations across Southeast Asia are achieving. The people of Southeast Asia are increasingly connected to each other and to the global economy. Entrenched dictatorships have given way to new democracies, and throughout the region, citizens are playing a greater role in their government and civil life. As President Obama said in Malaysia earlier this year, quote, "Perhaps no region on earth has changed so dramatically during the past several decades." With this change comes growing influence and greater opportunities to engage on the world stage. Asia's rise in global affairs is due in no small part to Southeast Asia's contributions. That's why the nations of Southeast Asia are and will remain a central focus of America's rebalance to Asia. We see the nations of Southeast Asia as equal partners in our mission to advance a vision that promotes growth and development, bolsters the security of nations, strengthens democratic governance, and advances human rights for all people. President Obama will continue this work when he visits the region again in November, including stops in China to participate in APEC, Burma for the East Asia Summit, and Australia for the G20 meeting. Southeast Asia and its markets are critical to American prosperity. Together, ASEAN comprises the seventh largest economy in the world and the fourth largest trading partner for the United States. ASEAN nations draw more U.S. investment than any single country in Asia. And with some of the fastest growing economies in the world, ASEAN will only become more important to our economic future. That's why we are committed to completing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One-third of TPP participants are from ASEAN, including members like Singapore, Vietnam, and Malaysia, for whom the high standard agreement means making serious new commitments. But this agreement will deliver tremendous benefits to all our economies, and we're committed to helping our partners meet TPP's requirements and realizing the opportunities for greater trade and investment that come with it. We're working to deepen our trade and investment ties to the region. That's why in June, Secretary Pritzker led a delegation of American businesses and American business leaders to the Philippines, Vietnam, and Burma to explore new commercial opportunities. U.S. Trade Ambassador Froman met with all of his ASEAN counterparts in Burma last month. Together, we are promoting growth that's broad-based and sustainable so that economies can compete on an equal footing and prosperity is shared among citizens at every level of society. Equally, Southeast Asia plays a vital role in maintaining peace and stability throughout Asia. We have long-standing alliances with Thailand and the Philippines, as well as an important security partnership with Singapore. In April, President Obama and President Aquino announced a new enhanced defense cooperation agreement that will strengthen cooperation between our militaries. We're also enhancing our security cooperation with nations like Malaysia and Vietnam, including by improving their capacity to contribute to maritime security. We continue to work with nations in the region on challenges that none of us can meet alone. This includes addressing borderless threats like climate change, responding to humanitarian crises like last year's super typhoon, countering violent extremism, and peacefully resolving maritime disputes among neighbors. To support cooperative solutions to these challenges, the United States has made historic investments to strengthen the region's institutions, including ASEAN. President Obama hosted the first U.S.-ASEAN leaders meeting in 2009, and it's now an annual event. The president sent our first resident ambassador to ASEAN, and the Senate just confirmed Nina Hachigian to fill the post in the coming years. This increased engagement with ASEAN has already delivered substantial benefits, including improved coordination in responding to humanitarian disasters, growing investment in developing the region's infrastructure and green energy resources, and rapidly expanding cooperation on maritime security and safety. We're also working with governments, institutions, and people to strengthen the democratic foundations of the region and to fortify protections for human rights. We've seen significant successes, as in Indonesia, which demonstrated the strength of its democracy through successful elections and peaceful arbitration. President Obama is looking very much forward to meeting with President-elect Widodo in November. We've seen hopeful steps as well in Burma, but significant challenges remain as we continue to work with the government and people as they pursue their democratic transition. Unfortunately, we've also seen troubling setbacks, as in Thailand. We remain committed to our alliance with Thailand and with the Thai people, but we want to see the country return soonest to an inclusive and democratic government. We're also building partnerships directly with the people of the region. We're doing this through programs like the Lower Mekong Initiative, which helps strengthen communities' ability to provide for their own health care, educate their children, and protect the environment. In Cambodia, USAID is working with local authorities to improve school enrollment among young children. In Indonesia, the Millennium Challenge Corporation is helping villages raise incomes while reducing their dependence on fossil fuels. And through President Obama's Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative, we're helping young people across the region build their skills and connect to the resources they need to serve their communities, create new businesses, and become the next generation of leaders. President Obama very much enjoyed hosting a remarkable town hall with many of these young leaders in Malaysia in April. They were entrepreneurs and activists and advocates, all of them impressive and thoughtful, and each determined to forge a brighter future. They wanted to know not just how they could become stronger leaders, but how to bridge the gaps of culture and language and belief in order to unite a region as diverse as Southeast Asia so that it can achieve its full potential. And that's a goal we share, because Southeast Asia is brimming with enormous potential. It's also facing serious questions about how to adapt as several major powers become more active in the region. China's rise, Japan's reemergence, India's revival, and of course, America's rebalance. These dynamics are real, and they converge squarely in Southeast Asia. But these trends ought to be an opportunity for greater cooperation, not just competition. Southeast Asian nations should not have to choose sides among major powers, particularly when it comes to the United States and China. Preserving the independence and sovereignty of all our partners in the region is at the heart of our policy in Southeast Asia. To be sure, America's relationship with China is important to the future of both our nations, to the region and to the world. I just traveled to China a couple of weeks ago and met with their senior leaders. In November, President Obama will meet again with President Xi to continue deepening our cooperation on major regional and global challenges, building a relationship that allows us to work together on shared interests and to talk frankly about areas where we disagree, including human rights. At the same time, we continue to build stronger bilateral relationships with the nations of Southeast Asia and to work together as equals in multilateral fora so that individual nations can preserve their independence while fostering a group dynamic that reinforces collective norms and prevents large states from pressuring small ones. That's another reason we focused on strengthening Asia's regional institutions, like the East Asia Summit. We want to build and reinforce habits that encourage collaboration, to establish a common set of rights as well as responsibilities that ultimately ensures a level playing field for all. All of the challenges I've discussed today require sustained attention. And even in the press of world events, ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, heightened tensions with Russia over Ukraine, an Ebola epidemic ravaging West Africa, the United States' commitment to Asia, and to Southeast Asia in particular, remains a top priority. The United States is a Pacific nation. Our shared future is as certain as our shared past. And the people of the United States and the people of Southeast Asia share a common vision for that future, a future where our daughters and sons can go to school and reach confidently for their dreams, where anyone can start a business and have a fair shot to succeed, where fundamental rights can never be restricted or denied. That's what we've been building towards over the last 5 years. That's why we've worked so closely together in pursuit of shared goals. Whether we're securing the sea lanes of the Pacific or delivering relief in the wake of natural disasters. With each year, the ties between our peoples grow stronger. And as we continue to work together toward our shared future, the United States will remain a reliable partner and a true friend to all the people of the region. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Susan. I think we all appreciate the fact that you have a few other pressing issues on your mind, and we appreciate your taking first the time and to be with us today and the vision you reflect in the statement you made. Thanks very much. And now it's my great pleasure to invite my new colleague, Joseph Liao, the first holder of the Lee Kuan Yew Chair, to the podium for a few remarks.
Minister Shanmugam, President Strobe Talbot, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor and pleasure for me to stand here as the inaugural Lee Kuan Yew Chair in Southeast Asian Studies. This is undoubtedly an exciting time to be in Washington, D.C. Issues are flying thick and fast as the global order we are all familiar with is confronted by forces that are chipping away at it. This, to me, is patently evident from the many discussions and debates that are taking place right here in this town, some of which I've had the pleasure of participating in. Now, as an academic, I am entirely convinced that intellectual capital must be brought to bear on many of these issues as we consider appropriate responses. It is also my conviction that Southeast Asia must have a voice in these discussions for all the reasons that the previous speakers have already highlighted. In the coming months and years, the Lee Kuan Yew Chair will aim to do this through a series of activities, such as seminars and talks. For most, however, the Chair intends to hold to Brookings' proud tradition of publishing informed, analytical research on policy questions of our time, especially as they relate to Southeast Asia. So do stay tuned. I should also mention that the current Chair is making a contribution to another rich Brookings tradition. I have joined your soccer team, the Brookies. Although after last week's game, perhaps the team would be better served if I just stuck to my day job. The chair has been named after a truly remarkable man. While much has been said about Lee Kuan Yew's role in building the Singapore of today, as a student of international politics, I have been far more interested in his contributions on matters of foreign affairs. In this area, I found his reading and articulation of international developments from a Southeast Asian perspective and the implications not only for Singapore but the region and the world truly unmatched. I'm also especially pleased that Brookings is home to the Lee Kuan Yew Chair. I can think of no better place. Brookings' emphasis on rigorous, analytical, independent research with impact, I believe, provides an excellent arena for scholarship to engage with policy. I've only been here 1.5 months, and I can already feel the intellectual energy and verve of this institution. It would be remiss of me not to also mention how grateful I am to the supporters of this chair, all of whom share a common objective of improving relations between Southeast Asia and the US. This, of course, includes the donors, but also my senior Brookings colleagues, especially Strobe, Martin Indyk, and Richard Bush. Finally, I would also like to place on record my gratitude to three people from back home. My bosses from the Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Dean Barry Desker and Chairman Eddie Teo, and Ambassador Chan Heng Chi, also a member of the governing board of RSIS. I am grateful to them not only for releasing me to take up this position, but for giving me their unstinting support and confidence. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon for the launch.
Previous speakers have identified both the opportunities and the risks involved with Southeast Asia today and for the rest of the region. There are the opportunities to build a wide-based prosperity that benefits all the people of the region. There are the opportunities to create stable and inclusive political orders. And there is the possibility that Southeast Asia will be one of two important venues for a constructive response to the revival of China as a great power. That's what we can hope for. That's what we can work toward. But I think that we also understand that there are risks involved. There is the risk that the economies of Southeast Asia will not make that transition to advanced economy status that Singapore has made. There is the risk that political systems in the region will transition, unfortunately, from political development to political decay and instability. And there is the risk that the response to China's rise will be marked by either an overreaction or an underreaction. There is, as Minister Shanmugam has indicated, a crucial role for the United States to play. We have played a crucial role in the past several decades. I believe we have a crucial role to play now. I think it's fair to say that Brookings as an institution for a certain period of time failed to keep proper attention on Southeast Asia, and that was our mistake. It's also fair to say that we have, with the establishment of the Lee Kuan Yew Chair, initiated our own policy of rebalancing. We're giving the region the credit it deserves. And I think our role in helping to shape U.S. policy is to be a source of sound, objective, analytical work based on in-depth research. And that is what we intend to do, to inform discussions both within government and in society more broadly. Having the Lee Kuan Yew Chair permits us to do that on a sustained and flexible basis. We're very fortunate to have Joseph Liao as the first holder of the chair. He's made an important contribution already in the brief 7 weeks since his arrival. In closing, I would say that in addition to the United States playing whatever role it did in the building of Southeast Asia, statesmen like Minister Mentor Lee Kuan Yew also played their role. He, I believe, as clearly as anyone, saw both the opportunities that existed for Southeast Asia to build a vibrant region. He also understood the risks involved in the geopolitics of the region. So I think there was no better person for us to name our chair after. It does impose a sense of responsibility on us, and we will do our best to meet that. I, too, would like to recognize the leadership of Strobe Talbot and Martin Indyk in this regard. That brings our program to an end. Thank you for your attention. We have a small reception through these doors here. But before we head for the reception, please join me in thanking our other, our previous speakers, Minister Shanmugam, Susan Rice in absentia, and Joseph Liao.